We'll start by starting to record, so that will get me off the hook for those who always remind me about setting up the recording. So we will go ahead and get started with our study this evening. If you'll just bow your heads, we'll ask God's blessing on our study. Our Father in heaven, we pause before you this evening as we're approaching your Sabbath day once again. We're thankful for the understanding we have of the day of the week, the time of your Sabbath, and also thankful for the understanding we have of the annual holy days, which will be coming up soon. It's a very special week and a very special time of the year. And we thank you for sharing that knowledge and understanding with us. As we begin our study this evening, and again in the book of James, I do ask for your blessing on the study itself. Your word is filled with so much wisdom and so much, there's so much there for us to understand and apply in our lives. And as we study your word, we're looking for your direction, for your instruction, and for your help. So we look to you for that and thank you for your love and patience with us and for the word that you've given to us, the word of truth. So I ask for your blessing on the discussion tonight, that we can benefit from it and head on into your Sabbath day. We thank you and pray to you in Jesus' name. Amen. All right. Tonight, I'm planning to review with you three more topics from the book of James. By my count, this is the eighth study we've had on this in this epistle, and what I'm planning is one more after tonight. But as I go back and I review my notes and prepare for the next study time, I always realize that there's much more that I should have said, could have said. There's more in the book than we'll be able to cover effectively in this study. So it is something that we always realize that there's more to be learned, more to study. So we'll do the best we can just to do an overview of the book of James. We probably could spend many, many more studies if we get into it really in detail. I know some of you have commented that James is one of your favorite books of the Bible. We all have those that we kind of relate to, connect with. But James has so much practical information in it and direction. It really, really strikes a chord with us on many different levels. So if we review it together, I hope that it'll open up more thoughts for you to study it a little bit further, even on your own. Just a very quick review, kind of, a list of the topics we've talked about so far to bring us up to tonight's study. We started, of course, by talking about the background of the book of James, a bit about James himself, the timing of the book, and the purposes that he had in mind. We spent a couple of studies talking about the first three verses that address trials, joy, and patience, and dealing with various trials and difficulties and circumstances in our lives. We then talked about praying in faith, which is one of the first topics he addresses, in particular praying for wisdom, but doing so with confidence and in faith. We talked about prayer also in terms of healing, effective prayer for healing in chapter 5. We talked about faith and works. Martin Luther, of course, rejects the book of James, the leader of the Protestant Reformation, because he didn't like that James emphasizes the importance of works and of obedience to the law. And we see in book of James how faith and works work together. They're not contradictory at all. We talked about godly wisdom and what it is, how we can have wisdom, how we can live in a way that reflects God's wisdom. We talked about the riches of God's blessings. He gives us every good and perfect gift in such a generous way. We spoke a little bit about the principle of being swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath. Obviously, a really important concept, and helps to, if we have that in mind, it has a great impact on our lives in on a constant basis. James also relates the sins of the tongue, and we talked about that in chapter 3, the importance of controlling our tongue and controlling the things that we say. We talked about what it's pure and undefiled religion. You know, we claim to be religious. We claim to worship God. What is it in our lives that shows that we practice pure and undefiled religion? In chapter 4, he speaks about fighting wars and love of the world, and the conflict that we have in our own lives and with others if we have the love of the world instead of a love of God. We talked about the importance of submitting to God and resisting the devil. A very important concept the promises given that if we do submit to God and resist the devil, then he will flee from us. And that's something, of course, we always want, is to win those battles that we fight on a daily basis. And we talked about the false value of physical wealth. People put their trust in wealth, and God calls them to task for that here through the book of James. So those are 13 different topics that we've talked about in our 8 or our 7 previous studies. And we're going to cover 3 more tonight as best we can. And then we have just a couple or 3 more that we'll finish up in the last Bible study in this series in the middle of September. So we're going to begin tonight in chapter 2, verse 8. Chapter 2, verse 8. And we'll be talking about what James calls the royal law of love. As we look at this passage, I'm sure that this is yet another one that Martin Luther would have strongly objected to, because James emphasizes the importance and the value and the beauty of the law that God has given to us, and the importance of being obedient to it. And again, showing that faith and works are not contradictory. Verse 8 here in chapter 2 is a kind of a continuation of a thought that started in the first 7 verses of this chapter, where James is writing about the warning against showing partiality. And that was apparently one of the issues that James dealt with he was concerned about in the epistle. I've got a note about that a little bit further in. We'll get to that in a minute. But the environment in which that James was addressing included some members who apparently, because of various stresses and difficulties, were not relating to each other in a very positive way. And there was some issue with partiality among the church at that time. I've got it right here. I'm sorry. I thought it was further on in the study. But here's a comment that comes from the New King James Study Bible. And it kind of explains why James addresses this issue. It says, most of the recipients of this epistle seem to have been poor and suffering from oppression imposed by their fellow Jews and Christians among whom they were living. Evidently, some of these Jewish Christians had been imprisoned and deprived of their possessions and livelihoods. Under such conditions, they fell into the clutches of worldliness, fought among themselves, favored the rich over the poor, and lost their original love for one another. Remember that James, as you see in chapter 1, verse 1, is writing to those Christians who've been scattered, and that scattering took place primarily because of persecution. So as they scattered and resettled, they dealt with some very serious circumstances, and it was reflected to some degree in the relationships that they had with one another. So here in verse 8 of James chapter 2, says, if you really fulfill the royal law according to the scripture, you shall love your neighbor as yourself, you do well. But if you show partiality, you commit sin and are convicted by the law as transgressors. Among other things, this shows us that there's a spirit of the law as well as the specific letter of the law. Because there's no law in scripture that says thou shalt not be partial. But the law is based on love and treating our neighbors as we would have them treat us, and loving them as we would have them love us. And so to do so in this a way that shows partiality and discriminates among members is a sin, according to what James has written here. This was apparently, again, a part of a kind of a class issue that was a problem within the church. If you fulfill the royal law of love, to fulfill means to keep or to obey. It means to value, to honor, and to obey the law is to fulfill it. And he speaks of the royal law. If you fulfill the royal law. This is the only time that this phrase is used in scripture. And there are a couple of possible explanations for what that phrase means, what James means by it. The royal law is, first of all, a law of supreme excellence. It is the highest standard. And it directs us in the excellence of life. It also is the supreme law above any other law. It's God's law, and it is supreme over any other law that may be. And it's the law that's given by God, who is royal above all. God is royal. God is the supreme sovereign of the world, of the creation. And so his law is royal, and it is fit for and prepares us for royalty in his family. So the royal law has a various number of nuances to it, and it certainly expresses the beauty and the value of that law. Verse 9 says, if you show partiality, you commit sin. So again, we are not, it's very important that we practice careful, that we're careful to respect and to honor one another. You know, Paul said in Philippians 2 to put other people ahead of ourselves is the way that we should live following the example of Jesus Christ. Verse 10 says that for whoever shall keep the whole law and yet stumble in one point is guilty of all. For he who said, do not commit adultery, also said, do not murder. Now, if you did not commit adultery, but you do murder, you've become a transgressor of the law. So James is illustrating that the law is spiritual and the law is unit, is unified. We can't just obey part of the law and ignore other aspects or the things that God instructs us in. If we violate any part of God's law, then we are a transgressor. We're a sinner. Now, it doesn't mean that if you commit adultery, then that means you're guilty of murder. The law is, there are separate instructions within the law, separate commands within the law. But the point is that God's commandments cannot be separated, again, so that you can obey some of them but not be required to obey others. Because God's law expresses his will. And if we violate a command, then we have transgressed his will. We've transgressed his law. Verse 12, so speak and so do as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. So speak and so do essentially means, look, walk the walk. Don't just talk the talk. What you say is what you must do. So you must, you say you obey God's law, then you have to live up to obedience of God's law. It's similar to what he said in chapter 1, verse 22, where he talked about being a doer of the law and not just a hearer of the law. And so we are reminded that we live by every commandment of God. Again, because those commandments express His will, and we don't want to violate His will in any way or in any detail. So speak and so do as those who will be judged by the law of liberty. We will be judged by God's law. God's law is the standard, and He expects us to obey it. And there is a responsibility, ultimately, for living up to it. This law defines how we should live, and that's very clear. We also see that God's law is a law of liberty. It's a law of freedom. In one sense, James is contrasting the oppression of the regulations imposed by Pharisees. James was a Jew. Many of his those who to whom he wrote, who received this epistle, were also Jewish in terms of their ethnicity, their background, and they were under the rule of the religious leaders of their time. And Jesus is speaking of the oppressive additional regulations that were imposed by the Pharisees. We also see that God's law itself is a law of not only of liberty, of freedom, but also a God of love. Remember, the two great commandments, love God and love man. And God's law is not to be changed or in any way altered by external regulations that are added by men. Again, the law of liberty shows us that God's law is a law of freedom. People tend to view law as being restrictive, being a restraint, being something that controls you. And it's kind of a negative connotation in many people's minds. Anything that they're told they have to do, they're going to reject, and they're not going to be willing to do it. But God's laws are a law of liberty because they show us how to live so that we can have true freedom. We can be free from the deceitfulness of Satan and his ways, and we can be free of the domination that he has over all of mankind, except for those who understand that law of liberty, that law of freedom, that law of love. So God's royal law defines how we should live when we have received the grace of God, when he's given us and relieved us from the penalty of death, saved us from the penalty of death by his grace, and then he shows us how we should live. Verse 13 says, judgment is without mercy to those who have shown no mercy, and mercy triumphs over judgment. Again, God's law is all about mercy. God is all about mercy. And as we've been shown his mercy, he expects us to also be merciful. There are many verses that express that concept or that make that emphasis. Let's look at Matthew chapter 5, verse 17. We'll just skip to back to Matthew for a little bit of what Jesus said in what we call the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 5, verse 17. We are told that Jesus didn't come to destroy the law, but he came to fulfill it. And and he emphasizes the importance of obedience. I don't think that's really the verse that I wanted to emphasize. Chapter 6, verse 14 is where I want is a better example. Matthew 6, verse 14, if you forgive men their trespasses, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men their trespasses, neither will your Father forgive your trespasses. So a very familiar principle that we have been shown mercy, and it's not just so that we can receive mercy, but that we can learn the lesson of being merciful. And if we're not merciful to others as God has been to us, then that's something that we will be held accountable for. We could look at chapter 7, verse 1. The way that people judge each other harshly is also a matter of not showing proper mercy. Chapter 7, verse 1, Jesus says, "Judge not that you may not be judged. For with what judgment you judge, you will be judged. With what measure you use, it will be measured back also to you." So it's a matter then of exercising, we'll go back to James now, a matter of exercising the principle that if we want mercy, if we expect God to be merciful to us, that we must also be merciful and forgiving to others. Then the phrase, mercy triumphs over judgment. God is a just God, and he will exact justice as he sees it is necessary. But God is also a merciful God, and he really is more interested in forgiving than he is in punishing or condemning. He doesn't tolerate sin, but God is willing to forgive sin when people are repentant, and when they have that right heart, that attitude. So in that sense, mercy triumphs over judgment. If judgment had the upper hand, then none of us would have any chance whatever, because we depend on God's mercy constantly. And so, again, as part of the lesson of learning to be merciful as we have been given mercy, and also just a recognition that God is a God of justice, but he's a God of mercy. And he is more interested in forgiving than he is in punishing. So James introduces this phrase and expands upon it a bit, the royal law of love. A little bit along the same lines, let's go ahead over to chapter 4, verse 11. This also has to do with our relationships with each other and showing the proper kind of respect and love, as is emphasized in what we just read. In James chapter 4, verse 11, he writes, "Do not speak evil of one another, brethren. He who speaks evil of a brother and judges his brother speaks evil of the law and judges the law. But if you judge the law, you're not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who are you to judge another?" So judgment is God's prerogative. It's under God's authority, and it's not for us to judge one another. That's the primary point that James is making. God will administer his law. God will administer both mercy and judgment as he sees that it is necessary. And James is saying that, look, when we take it upon ourselves to judge others, then basically we assume God's responsibility. We assume that we have the authority to judge another person. And judgment that humans administer or offer is almost always negative. You know, it's something that's a condemnation of another person. And so we are not to be judgmental. And we could go back. We were in Matthew 7. We could go back and read a couple more verses there. We saw that we must be willing to forgive as we have been forgiven, and that we're not to judge. We read the first two verses. Verse 3 says, "Why do you look at the speck in your brother's eye, but do not consider the plank in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, 'Let me remove the speck from your eye,' when you have a plank in your own eye?" So obviously, we're not in any position to judge anyone else. That's what it comes down to. And if we posture ourselves in that way and we're critical of another person, then we're just simply way out of bounds. And we're assuming the responsibility and the prerogative that God has. Another way to apply this, the principle here in these two verses, has to do with the way we treat one another. Another way that we judge another person is through gossip. gossip is a form of condemning someone else. There's many scriptures that warn us not to slander, not to speak against one another. That's a form of judgment. It's very common, and it's something that members of the church even have to struggle to control. Look at, we'll just turn a couple of pages ahead to 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1. Therefore, laying aside all malice, all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and evil speaking. Speaking evil of others is something that we are to put aside. People sometimes speak evil of another in a subtle way, or trying to justify what they're saying by making the comment that, well, I just want to tell you this so you can be praying about this situation or praying for this person. But at the same time, what is said is not something that's positive, not something that's uplifting. We're to edify one another, as Paul emphasizes in his epistles in Ephesians and Colossians both. There are a lot of proverbs that warn about speaking harmfully toward one another. It's a form of judgment, of condemning someone else. And this basically comes under the heading of gossip. Let's go back to Proverbs chapter 16, verse 28. Proverbs chapter 16, verse 28 says, "A perverse man sows strife, and a whisperer separates the best of friends." It's a form of, again, of judgment, a form of being a superior to someone else, to be the one who relates someone else's weaknesses or sins or mistakes. And it's a form of judgment that is something that is very harmful. Chapter 17, verse 9. Chapter 17, verse 9 in Proverbs. "He who covers a transgression seeks love, but he who repeats a matter separates friends." Covering a transgression doesn't mean to misrepresent or lie on someone else's behalf, but it just means to not be the one to want to run around and spread it around. People make mistakes, and we make mistakes. We wouldn't want or don't want others to be quick to judge us, but rather to have the patience and the mercy to recognize that most of the mistakes we make are not ones we intend and not something that we want to harm someone else. So it's not our place to run around and expose other people's so-called sins. And if you whisper, you get somebody's ear and you've got this very interesting tidbit you want to share, that destroys relationships. So these two verses here in James 4 that do remind us not to judge one another are very critical to our relationships within the church. It's amazing how some people, A, cannot keep something to themselves. If they know something, especially if it's interesting, especially if it's negative about somebody else, they just got to tell somebody. It's also interesting that people in some ways just don't know the difference between in conversation and gossip. And they just have to get in their negative statements about somebody else. So, again, James is very practical. He's talking about practical Christianity. And this is something for us to consider in our relationships and in the way that we respect and deal with one another, not to be judgmental. So let's move on then to another topic here that James emphasizes. And that begins in chapter 5, verse 7. James chapter 5, verse 7 says, therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. That's, I think, a very appropriate topic for us to consider as we are drawing close now to the fall holy days, which highlight the events that take place leading up to and including the return of Jesus Christ. Be patient until the coming of the Lord. Patience here is a general kind of a quality that we should have. Clearly, James is primarily making the point that we need to have faith and endurance, which are reflection of patience as we await the return of Jesus Christ. We deal with a lot of stress. We deal with a lot of personal issues. We see the world around us coming apart. And life is not easy or simple in many ways. But James says, be patient as you look forward to, as you anticipate the return of Jesus Christ. Turn back just a couple of pages into the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews has many different references to faith and to endurance. Let's look at a couple of them here. Hebrews chapter 3, verse 12. It says, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. This is talking about, again, an illustration of why gossip is so harmful. What we ought to be doing, as is expressed here, is supporting one another, encouraging one another, and not judging one another. Because with others, it takes our own effort, but we can encourage each other as well to remember, to remain faithful. Verse 14, for we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. Be patient as you're awaiting the return of Christ. Be steadfast in your belief and in your confidence. The word steadfast means to be firm, means to be stable and certain. So the encouragement is to be firm, be stable, be certain, be patient. All the way to whatever the end might be, whether it's the return of Jesus Christ or the end of our lives as we anticipate his return. Chapter 6, verse 12. Hebrews chapter 6, verse 12. It says in verse 10 that God is aware of our works and how we serve one another. In verse 11, we desire that each one of you show the same diligence to the full assurance of hope until the end. Again, patient, continuing in doing what is right and in developing the right relationships with one another, showing diligence. Don't become sluggish. But it says in verse 12, imitate those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. We have many examples all around us of people who are very faithful, and we can be encouraging to one another, very much the opposite of the attitude of judgment that was spoken of earlier here. And then chapter 10 in Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 10. The author here is reminding them of how they cared for him when he was in need. You had compassion on me in my chains, it says. He was apparently imprisoned. And you joyfully accepted the plundering of your goods. In other words, you willingly endured the persecution and the difficulty that came early in your time, in your calling, your time in the church. Verse 35, then he gets to the point, based on what you have experienced and in the faithfulness you have shown, therefore do not cast away your confidence, which has great reward, for you have need of endurance. And that Greek word translated endurance is also elsewhere translated patience. You have need of patience. You have need of endurance so that after you've done the will of God, you may receive the promise. So the point that James is making is that we are to, again, to wait patiently, to be confident, to be steadfast, to endure whatever challenges, trials, and difficulties we have. Some may relate eventually to persecution, but certainly we have much that we're enduring now, that we are going through, that we're experiencing difficulties in our own personal lives, but we are to patiently endure those circumstances as we look forward to the return of Jesus Christ. The word patience itself is also, as I've mentioned, translated endurance. It also is translated long-suffering. And of course, long-suffering is one of the qualities or part of the fruit of God's Spirit, to be willing to endure and to suffer and to remain calm in the face of those misfortunes. So that's a more general sense of patience, to deal with the difficulties of life. It says in the lexicon, to do so without complaint or irritation. And it's easy for us to be irritated. It's easy for us to be dissatisfied. We should remember, we could do another kind of a study within the study about how the Israelites complained and they were irritated. They were annoyed with God for the circumstances that they were having to endure. And so the point that James is making is that don't be rattled. Don't be overwhelmed. Don't complain because of the circumstances that you're enduring, but continue on with patience as we look forward to the time of Christ's return. We saw back in chapter 1, verse 3, that the testing of your faith produces patience. You know, when we endure certain kinds of circumstances, these things that as we talked about, those trials prove and strengthen and purify our faith. And in doing that, we learn the lesson of patience. And patience is certainly the lesson of any kind of a trial, because we have to endure to the end of those circumstances. So this concept of patience applies in a general sense, but it also specifically implies the endurance that we need as we anticipate and look ahead to the return of Christ. So back to James 5:7, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. A familiar analogy, a pretty obvious of a comparison. A farmer prepares the ground and plants his crop, but then he has to have patience. Then he has to wait for the crop to grow. And he knows that it will. He's as a farmer, he knows that that crop will mature. It will grow. It'll be something that can be harvested. But he's waiting. In this case, it says waiting for the early and latter rains. There was a rain cycle in Palestine. The early rains came in the fall after a new crop was planted, and then the latter rains. The early rains came in the late autumn when the crop was planted. And then as spring approached, there were the latter rains that helped that crop to really mature and grow so that by late spring, early summer, it was ready to be harvested. So there was the cycle that they were accustomed to, and they knew to be patient and to wait. And so that's a kind of a analogy or maybe a metaphor that helps us to understand what we're waiting for also. Not a farmer, never really have been, not really experienced with even growing a garden. We just don't have that opportunity in our yard. However, I do have a brand new fresh crop of grass. There's a section of our yard that for years, ever since we've lived here, we've never been able to get grass to grow. So I decided this summer I was going to grow me some grass. And so I worked on the soil. I put in some special soil that was supposed to facilitate the growing of grass. And I put the seed down carefully and then covered it a bit so that it wouldn't be bothered by the birds or other critters. And then I had to be patient. In my case, I provided the rain. I watered my little patch of dirt twice a day for 3 weeks. But after the first week, the little sprouts of grass began to show up. It was kind of, I was waiting, I guess patiently, maybe not so much, but I was waiting anxiously for the grass to begin to grow. And so now after it's been about three and a half weeks, and the grass looks really nice. It's still young, it's still fragile, but there's grass in my yard. And so I've seen a little bit of this growth or planting and nurturing cycle. I knew the seed was down there. It was working away, and finally it began to show up. We're working in our lives, and we're waiting as God is going to send Jesus Christ, and we're anxiously anticipating that time. Chapter 5, verse 8, you also, he says, be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Again, the emphasis is on being patient, and also says to establish your hearts. Other translations read this way, be patient and stand firm, or be unwavering. Be patient and take courage. Be patient and strengthen your hearts. Be patient and keep your hopes high. This phrase to take courage means to, in effect, stand above the trials and the issues and the concerns that you have. Set your mind, set your heart, that you will not let trials overwhelm you. Obviously, prayer is necessary, praying for the strength that we need, but ultimately it's our decision. How are we going to deal with those circumstances? Our faith in and our expectation of the return of Jesus Christ gives us something beyond those issues that we're facing, those difficulties, that those hazards we have in life. So we look at the issues, we experience the trials, the difficulties, the grief at times, and we control our mind, we set our mind, we set our hearts to not let that defeat us, but instead to look ahead in confidence to the help that God gives us and to the return of Jesus Christ. He says that his return is at hand. James is expressing his expectation that Jesus will return. He says to be patient until he returns, but he's expressing that is his expectation. And certainly that is the mindset that we have as well. It's not a matter necessarily of saying, well, you know, James thought that Christ was going to return in his time, but he didn't. Very likely the case. But what's important for us is that this describes the mindset of the New Testament church. Jesus, and part of the Olivet prophecy, Jesus gave examples of and parables about anticipating and being ready for the return of Jesus Christ, to always think of it as being at hand. The servants in the household were given responsibilities, and they were to be carrying out those responsibilities so that whenever the master of the house came home, they'd be ready. Whenever. Maybe now, maybe much later. The parable of the 10 virgins in Matthew 25. The point given at the end of the parable is, "Watch, therefore, for you know neither the day nor the hour in which the Son of Man is coming." So, at hand is the mindset that we are to have as the church. We're always to be looking for and anticipating the return of Jesus Christ. We are that household that Jesus referred to in the parable in Matthew 24. And we are to be continually fulfilling our responsibilities so that when he does return, then we'll be prepared. And so the message throughout the New Testament is that anticipation and that mindset that his return is at hand. One other thought on that, and I think this might be a pitfall that we might inadvertently tumble into, and that is not to let the warning signs of prophecy work against our expectant attitude or frame of mind. In other words, we know that certain things are going to transpire and then Christ will return. So as we anticipate his return, I don't think we should be thinking in terms of, well, it can't happen yet because Europe hasn't come together as 10 nations. It can't happen yet because we need to have a certain kind of president who will make some decisions that will lead to the downfall of our nation. Can't happen yet because the Roman Catholic Church hasn't come together and assumed authority over the people. The purpose of prophecy is not so that we can calculate when things are going to happen, so that we'll know, now I need to get busy, now I need to take it seriously because these things are coming together. That's not what prophecy is for. What we need to do is to have this expectant frame of mind, as James is pointing out, as Jesus did point it out in his parables. Like faithful servants in the household, we're ready at any time for our master to return. And that's the mindset here that James is referring to and how we establish our hearts. Verse 9 says, "Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door." Again, having this expectation of the return of Christ, but there's another element of it here that is important to us to consider, you know, especially in stressful times. Patience can wear thin. Relationships can be damaged. Matthew 24 warns against people who will betray one another at the time of the end of the age. So we are to be patient, not only as we wait for Christ to return, but also patient with each other, not to allow stress, not to allow circumstances to cause us to be irritable, to be annoyed, and to judge one another, as we talked about just a bit ago. So this was something that James was concerned about as far as the relationships that he saw, that he was aware of. Again, a couple of verses just to relate to this. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. 1 Thessalonians chapter 3. Verse 12. And may the Lord make you increase and abound in love to one another and to all, just as we do to you, so that he may establish your hearts blameless in holiness before our God and Father at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ with all his saints. So Paul is expressing the need to increase in our love so that we'll be prepared together as his family or as his saints at the time when Jesus does return. So being supportive of and not being critical of, caring for one another, and not grumbling against one another is an important part of our relationship as we anticipate and look forward to the time of Christ's return and as we deal with all kinds of different stresses and challenges in our lives. Chapter 5, verse 14. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 14. It says, "Now we exhort you, brethren, warn those who are unruly." Warn those who are unruly. In other words, that's part of the relationship as well, that we not be difficult to get along with or out of control in our relationships. Comfort the faint-hearted, uphold the weak, and be patient with all. Be patient with all. Even as we deal with those who maybe are a little disruptive, those who are unruly, those who are weak and timid, be there to strengthen and help them, to exhort them in a positive way. But be patient with all is, again, another point that Paul makes in that statement. Back to James chapter 4. No, I'm sorry, chapter 5. Now in verse 10. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You've heard of the perseverance of Job and seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. The prophets are examples of being faithful and continuing in what was right, even though they were severely persecuted. They were ignored. They were rejected by those that they came to warn and that they were trying to help. So the prophets are examples of patience. They continued to deliver their messages faithfully, even when they were abused and rejected and even killed. Many of the prophets were killed by the people that they came to help. Jesus makes reference to that in Matthew 23, verse 37. Matthew 23, verse 37. Jesus says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing." Jesus had great love and concern for his people, but he mentions that the prophets who came to warn them were stoned, they were killed. And so back to James 5 now, the prophets, again, were faithful, even though they were abused, ignored, ridiculed, and rejected. They faithfully delivered their messages. Reference is made to Job as well. We often talk about the suffering of Job, how he handled it, what he learned from his experience. People often turn to the book of Job, and it is one of those books where you can read it and you can extract so many different kinds of lessons from it in terms of dealing with the trials that people have, some of them quite severe. Sometimes people even compare themselves to Job because of the severity of the trials that they experience. But James simply uses him as an example of patience. He endured. He had his issues. He had to learn to honor and to respect God more than be proud of himself. But he had the quality of patience. And what he experienced kind of illustrates the principle or the lesson we have in Romans 8, verse 28, that ultimately God's plan works out for the best for those who are called, and in Job's case, for Job who trusted in and honored God in spite of the challenges and difficulties that he was dealing with. Certainly much more severe, much more extreme than any of us would ever even come close to having to experience. So I'm gonna stop at this point. I wanted to go through three different principles or lessons or points or themes from the book of James, but it's already almost 8 o'clock, and the next one that I have would take another 20 minutes or so. So I'd really rather stop there and come back and not go overly long here this evening. So we've seen a couple of points that are made here that are part of the lesson that we have. Talked about the royal law of love, and we talked about patiently enduring until and as we anticipate the return of Jesus Christ. So those are the principles we'll talk about today. I will say that we'll have another study, one more study along this line. Next time will be on September the 11th. We will try to wrap up the book of James with our study next time. If I have to take, I'll try not to take any extra time, but I'll maybe try to rush through the points a little more quickly. We have still about three, I think, left to consider. But I also, since we're coming to the end of this series, I want to emphasize that if you have any questions, if you have anything you'd like to discuss further, if there's anything that comments or questions we have on the principles we've talked about, please be sure to let me know. It's most effective if you let me know ahead of time so that I can give some thought to answering. You can email me, you can text me, you can touch with me in many different ways. But if you have any questions, anything you'd like to have maybe more explanation of, or any other points you'd like clarification on, please let me know, because I'm always, I know that there are questions and thoughts and comments that would be valuable for us to include. So I have unmuted you as far as what I have control of. You may have yourself muted. You have to unmute yourself if you'd like to. But we're going to wrap it up for here for now. And if you have any comments tonight, you can wrap up with that. Questions or comments, suggestions? Feedback here that I'm going to able to hear above the interference. Please be sure to
thank you, Mr. Henson.
You're very welcome. We'll do our best to get to
thank you, Mr. Henson.
All right, everybody.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night. Happy Sabbath, everybody.
Happy Sabbath.
Good night and have a happy Sabbath. We'll see you. Bye now.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
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 Right.
3, 2, 1, goodbye.